Good afternoon. So last time we talked about some simple schedulers, probably the simplest we could come up with of first come, first served. We just run the first thing we get, then run the next thing we get, and keep run things just until they finish. And round robin, where we're concerned, well, first come, first serve, it runs things for too long. We didn't want to do that. So we just switch between things in the order they came in. And round robin, we started to introduce this complication that we had this parameter that we need to choose a time quantum, how long we let things run before we switch to something else. And this choice was a trade-off, that if we made the time quantum low, we'd make things fair, but we make our throughput bad, because in the limit, we'd just be spending all our time context switching, because the time quantum's so short that we'd barely run something and then need to switch to the next thing. And if we made it really high, we'd have the problem we were trying to avoid by doing round robin instead of first come, first serve in the first place, of being really unfair that if something comes in first, it's going to toggle the CPU time, maybe. And we had an interlude where we talked about a completely different kind of scheduling goal, where we just had some system administrator choice that some things are more important than other things, and we want to enforce that importance with priorities. And our idea with priority scheduling was that this was very strict, that if something had a higher priority, it ran first, no exceptions. Even though, as you thinking through this, you might say, well, if that goes first, then the things at the lower priority, maybe they don't get to run, and that was a real problem we had. But that's the consequence of having this strict notion of priorities. And given this idea of priorities, we had a way of exploiting that design to achieve a goal we hadn't gotten yet of minimizing turnaround time. So we looked at what turnaround time was for first come, first served, and we observed, well, it really depends on the order, and priorities enforce a particular order. So it turned out that by setting our priorities based on our shortest remaining time, giving us the shortest remaining time first scheduler, we minimized mean turnaround time. Now, we mentioned that, well, we can't actually implement that scheduler most of the time because we can't really measure remaining time unless we run it anyways. And if we run the thing anyways, that defeats the point of making a decision about what to run. So we have this approximation with priority scheduling that of multi-level feedback queues. So we had multiple levels of queues. Each level was a different priority. And our idea was that we'd maintain estimates of remaining time as the priority assignment. And we'd enforce these by, at higher priorities, having a shorter time quantum. So if the remaining time was longer than we estimated, we'd cut them off and move them down to a lower priority. So before I continue talking about multi-level feedback queues, any questions about material we covered last time? Okay. So with our multi-level feedback queues, had this idea, we always run the highest priority thing. In this case, it would be thread A is the first thing at the highest priority. And if it uses the whole time quantum, then we'd add it to the lower priority queue. That we'd say, we guessed that you had around 10 millisecond remaining time. We were wrong. And we assume that that means we should move you lower. If it finishes early, then we guess, okay, maybe we were too pessimistic. Maybe you're actually much shorter than 10 milliseconds. We should run you earlier. And by adjusting up or down, we get this behavior where we end up around the right place. We're not going to get to exactly the right place all the time, but that's okay because we don't actually know what the remaining time is going to be. We're just guessing that if we observe a particular amount of time being used now, it's going to be similar next time. So if the programs have consistent behavior, like if thread A is between 1 and 10, it's going to oscillate between priority 3 and priority 2 here. That's what this will do. And that means that everything, if it's consistent, will stay at the same place. And if it's not, we'll figure it out kind of quickly. Like, we might guess that something which wants to like use the CPU continuously for the next minute is going to have a really short remaining time and run at the highest priority, but it will get knocked down, and then knocked down again, and again, and again, and we'll relatively quickly learn to put it at priority 0. And when things stop using the CPU, we're adjusting their priority for next time, so we're using the previous CPU burst to estimate the next one. That's sort of the basic idea of multi-level feedback queues. That we're estimating the priority and we end up at the right place, hopefully. So to give an example of how this works, let's say I have A and B here, and A uses a lot of I/O and has these short CPU bursts, and B has long CPU bursts with occasional I/O. And with multi-level feedback queues, generally, we always start programs when we don't know anything yet at the highest priority. Why do we do that? Because we know that, you know, if it is actually highest priority, we want to make short runs. And if it isn't, we're going to learn pretty quickly that it's not, shouldn't be there because we have the shortest time quantum. So our first thing is when B finishes its I/O from starting, we're going to run it for the time quantum at priority 1, and then we're going to run A. In the case of B, we're going to see, oh, it finished but that time quantum, but it wasn't actually done, so it's still ready, but we demote it to the lower priority. And we do that as we look at what's the highest priority thing we can run, and we say, oh, A is on the list now, because A was runnable while B was running. So we're going to run A. And only when A finishes using the CPU at that highest priority will B, which is now at a lower priority, get to run. So now B runs. And B uses the whole time quantum. So something a little subtle here that I've done is that I wanted to enforce that we assume B had a certain amount of remaining time. And here, B used that remaining time in two chunks. In the middle, A got to run. And that's fine. I'm still measuring the quantum as the sum of this and this. I'm not including the time it was ready and not running. So if we're implementing this precisely, we're going to have to like track not just, you know, the time it's been running since we started it, but the time it's been running since it was ready at this priority. That's what we're going to enforce, because we're going to be interrupted by these little short remaining times. That's just normal, and that's what we wanted, because we were correctly figured out that A should have the highest priority. And B manages to try to use the whole time quantum at that middle priority, and it doesn't work out. It needs more time, and that means it gets demoted even further, but it doesn't use the whole very long time quantum at the lowest priority, so it gets promoted again, and we're in fact going to have this cycle where B goes between 2 and 3 and back and forth. And this is sort of the normal behavior we'll get with multi-level queuing. But we correctly figured out that A has these short CPU bursts, and A interrupts B just like we would want, just like shortest remaining time first is supposed to do. So questions about this example? So multi-level feedback cues seem like a pretty good scheduler, and they're pretty easy to implement, but they have some big problems. So one big problem is that I've been kind of assuming that programs are doing their natural behavior, but what if I wanted to get the best possible performance on a system with a multi-level feedback cue? Is there a way I can cheat? Like, I want to be like A, but I don't actually have a lot of I/O to do. What can I do to be scheduled like A and take priority over everything else? You know, I have a program, doesn't do much I/O, it has lots of computation, but you know, I want to get the computation done really fast. How can I write my program so that happens, even though it's all computation? There's a simple, relatively simple way I can cheat. Yeah, back there? Yeah, so your proposal is, well, I don't do I/O now, I can add a little I/O that's just really fast. And this is a strategy you could use. So you do a little bit of CPU work, and then you wait for a really fast I/O. Or do something else which yields the CPU for a really short amount of time. So it looks like you always have a very short remaining time, and multi-level feedback cues will correctly infer, yeah, you have a really short remaining time, and give you the highest priority because you've added this extra I/O-like operation to your program. And many people would say that's not a good property, especially if I'm thinking about like a multi-user system or a system where I'm running programs written by multiple people and some of those people want their program to run faster. So we might like to avoid this. So another issue is about fairness. So let's say I have a long computation that's not cheating, doesn't need any I/O, and it's not going to cheat. I have a bunch of programs that are processing data on disk and an interactive program. How much time is A going to get to run? Mix works, I'm using feedback cues, several priority levels. What's going to happen to A? Yeah. So you're saying A is going to starve. So what? Why is A going to starve? Okay, yeah, so A is going to have really high priority, and B is going to be somewhere in the middle. Because it's doing disk I/O, it's not going to have really long remaining times. So assuming our priorities separate these, which is what we hoped the scheduler would do, then C is going to be at the lowest priority, all the B programs are going to be higher, and there's so many B programs that A is basically never going to run. Yeah, there's enough work for the B programs to use all the CPU time, or almost all of it, so they're going to run instead. So this is a real concern, and you might say, okay, but this is what shortest remaining time first is supposed to do, but note that this also happens if A was just doing a very long computation and now wants to do something interactive. Same scenario, because we can't tell that A has changed behavior. We're not going to check for that. It's still not going to run. So questions about our starvation here. So because of this problem and another problem of oscillation, namely that the behavior of going between two different priority levels maybe isn't actually that good for predictability, there are different variants of multi-level fair queuing. So the variant I described previously is the one that's in Anderson-Dahlin. But there are other variants you'll see in practice. So in particular, Arpeggio Dassault Our other textbook has a version that avoids starvation. So by avoiding starvation, they've made a compromise that they're deliberately not doing what shortest remaining time first would do because they're worried about starvation. They've decided that shortest remaining time first is not important enough to override not having starvation happen. And they also kind of address this oscillation problem. So their changes are they don't increase priorities when a time slice is not used. Instead, they just increase everyone's priority periodically. And what you can think of this as is that this is both preventing starvation in that, you know, after a while, you always get a chance to run no matter what. So that's what that does. So that's just an anti-starvation tool that, you know, if you haven't run for a while, we'll let you run once at least. And also, this is an alternate way of dealing with, I thought you had like lots of CPU, but now you have lots of I/O. We can deal with that with this increasing you experimentally to unstarve you. That will also deal with figuring out, oh, you should be at a higher priority now than before. This is a different solution to that problem, but compromising on that shortest remaining time first goal. But this is an okay compromise because starvation is so bad. So many real OSs are okay doing things like this because they don't care about minimizing turnaround time that much. Okay, so questions? This idea? Now, you might say, I've been describing these theoretical schedulers. Does anyone actually use this? So FreeBSD, which is still kind of common among server OSs and has a history back to the original Unix, currently uses a scheduler based on the multi-level fair queuing idea. But it does some things quite differently. So one thing it does differently is that they have a different strategy for changing the priorities than dealing with time quantums. The time quantums are not set based on priority primarily. Priority is a factor, but it's not the primary factor. But instead, they explicitly compute an estimate of what priority you should be at, which they call an interactivity score. And that's based on how much time you spent waiting for I/O versus running recently. And then they adjust the thread priorities up and down based on that score. So it's a similar idea to multi-level fair queuing, but with a different mechanism for adjusting the priorities and without so much concern of like integrating that with the time quantum selection. They have other criteria for selecting time quantums that we'll talk about later in a different context that take precedence over that as far as their goals. Questions? Yes. Okay. So that's why I have a multi-level fair queuing. And you might see from what FreeBSD is doing is that multi-level fair queuing is sort of choosing a particular point about estimating this remaining time, which we might call interactivity. And they're not looking at remaining time. They're looking at, you know, measuring something that's related to remaining time, but a little closer to our goal of responsiveness. And they have these sort of compromises of like, how much work are they doing to make that estimate? So they have to track something for every thread that's in addition to the priority, so that's extra work. And how fast they adapt to new programs, you know, and deal with, you know, strange behavior. And you can see that their scheme has given them more flexibility in choosing among these options at the cost of probably being more complex and slower. Okay. So that's where I'm going to leave off on the scheduling goal of sort of shortest remaining time first, low turnaround time, or interactive processes. And we're going to go to a different scheduling goal that we sort of touched on with round robin, a fairness. So I'm going to start by, let's make a fair scheduler. And what's the fairest scheduling we can do? Well, we've kind of seen it. Every thread has an equal chance to be chosen. And round robin does this, except it doesn't, like, every thread doesn't have an equal chance to be chosen because there's an exact order. And I'm going to give you a hypothetical scheduling algorithm which is perfectly fair in the sense of every thread has an equal chance to be chosen. And that's, we're going to schedule at random. We're just going to choose from the ready threads uniformly at random every time we have to choose a thread. And this scheduling algorithm, you're going to implement a variant of this for the next homework assignment. But we're going to add something into this, that this is a nice, fair scheduling algorithm, and it's going to have some problems, like it's not good for predictability, for example, because we're literally making a random choice. But you know, it just says everything's equal, and we know that that's not really how things are. Let's say threads are not equal, and we have some notion that like thread A is twice as important as thread B. And you might say, okay, if that's what your idea is, that you know, one program is twice as important as the other, shouldn't we use priority scheduling? But priority scheduling doesn't match many people's intuition for what twice as important means. If I tell you, you know, that something is twice as important and then now assign resources, most people don't assign everything to the twice as important thing and nothing to the half, you know, half as important thing. But that's what priority scheduling would do. Most people's intuitive notion, if I say twice as important, is, well, it should get twice as much stuff. So we're going to make a scheduler which actually does that, which gives it twice as much stuff. And we're going to do that based on this randomness idea. So thread A will run twice as much as B, and this is called a proportional share, that everyone has their fair share. You know, and fair doesn't, in this case, mean equal. It's an equitable share where we've assigned what the proportions are, which might be like a system administrator-based decision. And the simplest way of implementing this is to use this random scheduling idea, but we're just going to get rid of this uniformly part. That if A should run twice as much, then we're going to choose A twice as much. And this is what we'll call lottery scheduling, that we can think of every time we need to figure out a thread to run, we're going to run a lottery, and we're going to give each of the threads that are available to run a certain number of tickets. So A has 100 tickets, B has 200 in this case, and C has 100. And we're going to say, hypothetically, each of the tickets has a number, and we're just going to choose a random number among all the tickets at uniformly to decide what thread to run. Whichever thread wins this lottery gets to run for the next time quantum. So we've kind of extended our fair scheduler to have this extra flexibility where we can define what it means to be fair. And this means that we can actually use this to simulate all sorts of other schedulers in a sort of approximate way. So here, I'm just saying B runs twice as much as A and C, A or C individually, and about as much as them put together over time. But we can also say simulate priorities. So how would I simulate priorities? Yeah.
Give the more important
process more tickets. Okay, so that's how we simulate priorities. Now, it's never going to be perfect, but we can like make the amounts really divergent. So I can like give A a million tickets and C one. And this is going to be very close to what our priority scheduler would do. that A is going to run, instead of B, you know, 1,000 times, you know, 999 times out of 1,000-ish, you know, most of the time, and so on. And we can even use this to implement an SRTF approximation, like multi-level fair queuing, or feedback queues, which is that, you know, we just set the priorities like we would for feedback queues, assign them ticket counts. We're simulating multi-level feedback queues. And this actually gives us a little extra flexibility, depending on what we make this ratio here. So here I'm saying higher priority is 1,000 times the tickets. If I make that like 10, I'm adjusting how much things at the lower priority are starved. You know, we can think of this as sort of a continuum between our strict priority notion and our fully fair notion, depending on what relative amounts we set. So you can think of this as a way of adjusting, you know, between our round robin scheduler and our strict priority scheduler, where we get the good parts of the priority scheduler that the right thing usually runs first, and we get the good parts of the round robin scheduler of not having starvation. So you're going to implement a lottery scheduler in XV6. This is why I spent time going over how the internals of the scheduler worked, so you actually might maybe be able to figure that out when we get there without having to like read a lot of C code that you've never heard of before. So you're going to add an extra system call called setTickets, and you're also going to count how often processes are scheduled. So we have some idea what your scheduler does without needing to write some complicated, like do some computation, see how fast it runs sort of benchmark. And there's going to be some simplifications over how you'd really do this lottery scheduling thing. So, you know, you're going to run a lottery, and I am going to say it's okay if you do that kind of inefficiently. So it's okay if you take linear time, meaning if I have 5 programs running, you're doing 5 operations. If I have 30 processes running, you're doing 30 operations to figure out what to run, where in a, you know, efficient implementation of this, you'd want to avoid that because that leads to really bad performance. You know, we talked about the context switch overhead. There's also the overhead of making a scheduling decision. And if that gets worse, the more threads you have, you know, that kind of compounds because you're not only context switching more because you have more threads, you're also making more complicated scheduling decisions. The whole system slows down a lot. And it turns out there's a way of running these lotteries that's not linear time, but this is not an algorithms and data structures class, so we're not going to talk about it. Also, we're not going to do things about precise time quantum. So we're just going to say you're going to use the same time quantum that XV6 uses now, even though that gives kind of uneven time quantums. Because like if I start at a timer interrupt and then wait for keyboard I.O., then another thread runs until the next timer interrupt. It runs for less time than it might otherwise. We're not going to care about trying to compensate for that in any way. Even though on a real list, that might be something you're concerned about. Is, you know, if something runs for shorter amounts of time, we should do something about that. So questions about the scheduler assignment. Okay. So this is a nice simple scheduler, and it lets us implement a wide variety of policies. We just need to set those proportional shares. So we can get our round robin-like things, we can get our priority-like things with varying amounts of starvation. So it seems useful. But you might say, it seems kind of wonky that we're just like choosing random things. Would we really do that? Well, maybe. So this is seriously proposed by academics in 94. And that there's a paper, if you want to read up, how do I make this efficient? How do I do preemption in a good way? How do I, you know, handle if they don't use the whole time quantum? How do I handle scheduling things that aren't the CPU, like disks and memory? But they're problems. And they're problems, which means that we're going to talk about a scheduler with a very similar goal to the lottery scheduler that's in Linux, but that works in a very different way, because we're avoiding some problems kind of glossed over. So let's mention one problem. So let's say I have, using lottery scheduling, and I give thread A one ticket, thread B 9 tickets. So our intuition is thread B should run 9 times as often as thread A. So over 10 time quantum, we should schedule thread A about once and thread B about 9 times. But we know it's a random choice, so this is not always going to happen. So my question is, what's the probability we schedule A in these 10 time quantum 3 times as much as we should? So 3 times instead of 1. I'll give you a minute. I'm looking for an approximate number. Computing the exact number is actually very annoying. So okay. So who would like some more time? Okay, who has an answer to share? There. You said about 0.34. So how did you get that? So this is 34%? Okay. Yeah.
I did 10 to the degree times the probability that A would run to the third power times 9 tenths.
Okay, so, okay. Not sure. That's not the number I got. But that's the same number, that's a different quantity that's also very concerning. Yeah.
I got 0.057-ish.
Okay, so you got 0.057. So you got about 5.7%. And so this was trying to estimate what?
Like the number, if it's chosen 3 times out of 10.
So chosen 3 times out of 10.
Yeah. So okay. 1/10 times.
Yeah. So I agree that this is when I did this calculation earlier, which is very tedious because we're getting numbers like 0.057. This is the number of times it would be chosen 3 times out of 10. But we're asking for at least 3. So the real answer is slightly higher, and it's around 7%. Um, And if you like go through your binomial distribution, or the way I computed this, you write a little simulation because you aren't confident that you are using the right binomial distribution, and you don't want to have wrong numbers on your slide, and you get the probabilities, you get roughly this. So 34% is the chance that it's chosen never, which is very concerning, actually, that it's supposed to be one time out of 10, 30% of the time it doesn't run at all. That's a problem if we're thinking about like starvation, that yes, it prevents starvation in the long term, but we still have just random starvation in the short term because, you know, 30% of the time it won't run once every 10 times. Just because of how the probabilities work. Yeah. So this is a binomial distribution, which you should know from, which you should look up your probability to do. I'm not going to teach probability. As I said, the way I figured it out is I just ran a simulation because I wanted to assume I was choosing the wrong binomial distribution and wanted to make sure I had the right things. And you see that we have, you know, and we're choosing what's more than three times. And that's 7%. And 7%, well, that's pretty small. And that percentage is going to get bigger when instead of asking what's going to run, you know, three times out of 10, is going to be like 30 times out of 100. That 7% is going to get smaller. But 7% is actually pretty often if we think of, like, you know, whether my interactive program runs quickly or not. Because that's the difference between, like, one out of 20 times, it's going to like hang for a little bit because we're running something else for too long. That's what we're saying with this. That if the program B is our interactive thing that needs to run soon and program A isn't, we're saying that, you know, 7% of the time it might hang for a little bit because we decide to run A too much. And that's not great. We'd like more consistency. We don't actually like having these random effects and things like our desktops or our phones or our servers that are like serving web browsers. Like, this is not usually actually acceptable. And this is a big practical issue with the scheduler, is that we have this big variation just because we're doing random choices, and over short periods of time, we aren't making many of those choices. Over the long term, when we're making thousands of choices, yeah, the probabilities are going to even out and be pretty close to the distribution we want. But over the short term, we can have these big deviations. So that's one big issue we have with this lottery scheduler. So another issue is about our notion of fairness. So the fairness notion we've been talking about is dividing up the CPU time fairly among the things that can be run now. If a program's waiting for I/O, it's not involved. We don't care about programs that aren't runnable. We don't care about what happens when the program's not runnable. We just say, if you can use the CPU now, it's fair to divide it up evenly or proportionally if we have those, you know, shares, those numbers of tickets. But we're not considering anything about what happens when you're not waiting for I/O. We're just dividing up the time when you are available to run. And this is often not actually what we think of as fair, that we really want to give programs credit in many cases for times they're not running while waiting for I/O. Even though we can't run them then, you know, they're going to end up just getting less CPU time because they're doing I/O, so we're not going to divide up the CPU fairly. And I'll give an example of that in a second. Now, it will be useful to talk about defining fairness precisely because we're going to look at a scheduler which is going to use a very precise definition of fairness to kind of motivate it. And one way of defining fairness is going to be max-min fairness. Is that we're going to choose the schedule that maximizes the minimum resource anyone gets. That's what's going to be most fair. So, for example, I have a bunch of schedules here. So most fair is dividing up so everyone gets the same amount. That's like what you expect. But then we're saying we want to maximize the minimum. So this is more fair than this because our minimum here is better. And this here is more fair than this because even though, you know, we have one thing getting a lot more here, that's better than one thing getting way too little, is our notion. That because this bar here is shorter than these here, that this is least fair under this definition. And you can see from the last two examples why I said it's hard to define fairness, because you're not wrong if you think intuitively we should consider the second to last one more fair or less fair. You're not wrong with that. Like that's a subjective call, and we could make up a definition pretty easily which ranks these differently. Okay, so questions about how I'm defining fairness here. So thinking about this, let's think about an example here. I have two processes in a lottery scheduler with the same number of tickets. A is CPU bound, and B does lots of I/O, but it can still use half the CPU. It has enough work to use half the CPU, but it does a lot of I/O. Yeah. So it like does I/O, like it wants to do I/O if it was running alone, like maybe 30% of the time or something like that. And the lottery scheduler is going to say, run them equally when both can run. Because when both can run, we're going to choose A or B at random. When only A can run, well, we're going to choose A. It's the only thing in the lottery. And the result is that B runs a lot less than A. So we have 50% when they're both runnable, 100% A when only A is runnable. Means A gets more than 100% over time, B gets less than 50% over time. So is that fair? Well, depends what you're measuring for fairness. One way of saying is, yes, it evenly splits up the time when both programs are runnable. That's one way we could measure what we're dividing up fairly is the time, amount of CPU time you get among the things that are runnable right now. But another way of measuring fairness would say, well, we just consider CPU time over time, and well, B is getting less, it's not fair. So the lottery scheduler, yeah, it's fair, but this is maybe not the kind of fairness we care about. We often really do care about that in this scenario, we should have equal CPU time. That would be what fair would be. So we're going to have a scheduler that avoids this. I'm going to talk about Linux's scheduler, which is going to be a mechanism for dealing with it, for providing this kind of fairness. You know, more of this kind of fairness than the other, and it's also deterministic. We're not going to make any random choices, but we're still going to do that proportional share thing where you can be twice as important and run twice as much. So it's deterministic proportional share scheduler, and we're going to give processes credit when they're not runnable, so we're not going to end up having that scenario I just talked about, you know, split things up unfairly because we only care when both were runnable. We're going to care a bit about when programs are waiting for I/O briefly. You know, we're going to say that just because you're doing I/O doesn't mean you get less CPU necessarily. So it's a very nice scheduler. It's called the completely fair scheduler. So it's no randomization. It actually even makes a log n scheduling decision. So it's pretty efficient, it's not going to do any linear time searching, and it has a way of favoring interactive programs. Also, it does some things with the time quantums that are interesting and sort of an orthogonal thing to the choice of what to run when. So the key thing we're talking about is sharing the CPU evenly. And how do we do that without making a random choice, but still have these weights? So we'll first ignore weights. We'll just say, how do we do that, you know, just statically? And your notion would be, well, we start with round robin, but round robin doesn't let us take into account time when things weren't running. So we're going to have a way of taking that into account, and that we're going to track how much CPU time has it got. And if we recall my definition of min-max fairness, so we want to have everything have the same amount of CPU time it gets to use. So you want to maximize the minimum virtual runtime. So that means to increase the minimum amount of CPU time something got, we're going to run the thing which has the lowest amount of CPU time it got. That's always what we're going to run next. So we're always going to make things more fair by that metric. And we're going to call this amount of CPU time you've gotten your virtual runtime. And we're going to increment it every time you run based on how long you ran. And we can even do this efficiently with a balanced tree to track all the virtual runtimes by time. Now, I mentioned we're going to do proportional share. So how are we going to do our twice as important? Well, rather than using the actual how long it ran, we're going to have adjustments be multiplied by a factor. That we're going to add, you know, say that if you're twice as important, your CPU time counts for half as much time. So you should get twice as much. And we're just going to do that by when we track how much CPU time you get, we're going to say every millisecond you get is half a millisecond as far as everyone else is concerned. There's also something we're going to have to do about threads that are new or were sleeping. So if we have a new thread, we can't just start it at zero. Well, we can, but this would say that new thread, congratulations, everything else was running for 2 minutes, you got to catch up and run for 2 minutes. This is probably not what we want. Think of like, I start my web browser after using my computer for an hour, and now my web browser hogs an hour of CPU and nothing else works in that time. You know, that would not be acceptable. So we need to make some sort of compromise that they can't start at zero. And the same is going to be true for things that were sleeping for a long time. If I start my web browser when my computer starts, but don't touch it for an hour, it also shouldn't be the case that it gets to hog an hour of CPU time when I start touching it. So we don't want things to be too out of whack. Even though we do want, like, over medium periods of time, like seconds or minutes maybe even, that we even up the CPU time, we don't want to do it over like hours at the cost of letting something run continuously for an hour. So to avoid that, we're going to have these adjustments when things, you know, we're waiting for I/O or not running for a while for any reason, we're not going to let them have a virtual runtime that is way too low compared to everything else. Because otherwise we'd create a sort of starvation-like problem. Okay, so questions about this basic scheme before I go through some examples. Okay. So if everyone wants to use the CPU all the time, this scheme turns into round robin. So here I have A, B, and C are three threads. Here's their virtual time, and I'm saying they have no weight. So they're multiplied by one. So A runs for 1 millisecond. That's our time quantum in this example. And now it has a virtual time of 1.5. And we look at what has the lowest virtual time. It's B. B runs for 1 millisecond. Now C has the lowest virtual time. And then A is going to have the lowest virtual time. And we'll go in this round robin fashion, assuming everything uses a whole the same time quantum over and over. So this is, in fact, exactly round robin if everything wants to run all the time. Yes?
So basically, this is assuming that the three processes start with already having been run for X amount of seconds.
The question is, what am I assuming as the starting condition? So somehow A got credited for 0.5 milliseconds, B 1.25, and 1.4 before we started this example. So maybe that's because they started up. You know, or maybe that's because we figured had some other way of setting their initial times. But probably it's because we started them up and they used a little CPU time before what I'm showing here. Okay. Other questions? So we're always just keeping track of this virtual time, running the lowest one, we get round robin in the sort of everything's always ready, always using the whole time quantum scenario. So then we have to worry about things waiting for IO. So we want to give an advantage if you wait for IO for a little amount of time and then come back. And I say an advantage because we want to, you know, not have you only get the time while you were running. You want to give you some credit for waiting for IO so you, over time, use the same amount of CPU as if you were always running. But we don't want to give you too much. So the solution that Linux uses is that the virtual time for something which just became ready is its prior virtual time, or if that's too small, we have like something a little less than the current minimum virtual time. So we like bound how much time you can hog the CPU for if you just became ready, so it can't be like an hour. And really, probably so it can't be like more than like tens of milliseconds. So let's think about, you know, how this works. So if you're not runnable briefly, you'll still, over time, get your full share of CPU. But if you're not runnable for like minutes, well, we're not going to let you run for extra minutes while other things want to run to compensate for that. So let's give an example of not being runnable briefly. So here, I'm going to start having A, B, and C. So A runs for a little bit of time because it has the lowest priority and the lowest virtual time. And A runs for half a millisecond, and then it's doing some IO. And this means that B gets to run. So because A is not ready, we can't run A, so we run the lowest virtual time of anything which can run. And then A comes back, it's ready again after B finishes, and it still has the lowest virtual time. And this is something which will kind of naturally happen to things which spend most of their time doing I/O, is that they'll always tend to have the lowest virtual time, so they'll get priority. So in this sense, even though this is a fair scheduler, we're actually achieving the goal of having good interactivity, that because things that are interactive tend not to use the CPU that much versus doing I/O, we will tend to run them quickly. Even though that wasn't our scheduling goal and isn't what we're optimizing for. So then let's say A finishes and is still runnable. Now then A has a higher virtual time, C gets to run, and when C finishes, A still has a lower virtual time than B, so we aren't doing round robin anymore. We're giving A priority, you know, giving it credit for having done this I/O, which has kept its virtual time, the amount of CPU time it's gotten lower. So when it is runnable, it gets to run more often. So over the long term, you know, over the period of like a minute, we'll see that A still gets its share of the CPU. It still gets like close to a third, even though there was a lot of time it was doing I/O. Some questions about this? Yeah. So the question is, what about, so I'm storing these run times in some sort of number, don't I like run out of space? So yes. So I think Linux has a way of dealing with wraparound somehow. I don't actually remember the details. Also, it uses 64-bit ints to make it be rare that it has to deal with it. But yeah, that is a concern. Okay. So this is an example where I had A doing a little bit of I/O. So before I move on, any other questions? This example. So here A was doing a little bit of I/O, but if A was doing a lot of I/O. So here I have B and C have been chugging away using the CPU for a long time, and A ran for a little bit of time and then was waiting for I/O for a long time, like waiting for me to press a key or waiting for something to come in on the network, which took like almost a second. And, you know, we're going to make a choice that, well, you know, we care about fairness, but we don't care about fairness enough to not let B and C run for over a second, which is what we'd have to do sort of for almost a second, which is what we'd have to do to, like, if A wakes up, right, and we don't adjust these virtual times. We don't adjust these virtual times. We're just going to keep running A for over almost half a second, and this is means that B and C are going to be starved noticeably. And that's something that Linux has chosen to avoid just as a choice. They said, yes, I know A gets less CPU time than its share, but it would be too bad to have B and C be starved for half a second of any CPU. So when A becomes ready, we're going to run it right away. So here you see that C got less than its full time quantum I chose. But now A, now ready, I limited its CPU time a bit. So I set its virtual time to a little less than the current one. And there's a choice here of how much less. I chose like a millisecond less, but that's a configuration choice that, you know, is a trade-off. And this means that, yes, A gets to run more than B or C right now, but not like a whole lot more. We're limiting how much advantage it gets for not having used the CPU time in advance. And in this example, we're saying A goes back to sleep. A is like doing a little bit of work from I/O. And in this case, because A is doing so much I/O, it always gets priority still with this scheme. But we guarantee that if A decided not to do I/O, that we wouldn't like starve B and C. Okay, so questions? This, yeah. So the question is, when A got ready, I chose the virtual runtime for C. I computed by saying C was at this, and it ran for, I guess in this case, I'm actually saying 0.85 milliseconds, and I added that 0.75 milliseconds. And I added that to C's virtual runtime, and I chose A's runtime based on the lowest of anything else. Yeah?
What if B has like the same CPU as A? So then your minimum would be like equal.
So the question is, how did I choose this minimum? Like, what would happen if B had a different time? So I chose the minimum based on everything that is runnable, already runnable. So if B had a lower time, then yes, I would. Then B would be running instead of C. So I don't have that concern. That I'm always choosing based on things which are already runnable. I'm never going to like look at other things which aren't ready or just became ready. I'm going to always look at other things which already were ready. Yes?
So there's no like time quantum that like it will basically switch the process when it reaches the like it's no longer the minimum virtual time?
So the question is, when do we do context switches when the virtual time is lower? And I haven't answered this question. I'll talk about when we talk about time quantum. And this is a tricky choice. The question is, what happens if I have two processes with the same virtual time? I don't know how the actual scheduler chooses. You have to choose one, and how they choose. But that's a reason why the answer is not going to be we switch immediately, right? We don't want to handle that scenario by switching back and forth between them like every microsecond. Okay. So I gave this example with everything having equal weight. We do proportional sharing by multiplying the use time by a weight. So we can make a program half as important by saying every millisecond of CPU you get costs 2. Okay, so that's the sharing part. So we're asked about like when do we switch away? I'll start by answering the question of like how long do we run things for? So what are our time quantums? And time quantum setting, we mentioned with round robin, we have this sort of compromise between fairness and throughput. And Linux tries to kind of explicitly manage this. So for throughput, they have this priority of don't let the time quantum be too short. That we want to spend at least 0.75 milliseconds running things, because otherwise we're worried the context switch overhead will be too high. And we'll do this even if this makes things unfair. But we want things to be fair, so we don't want to wait too long for a program that's ready to run to run. And the goal Linux has chosen by default is that we'll say every 6 milliseconds, we should try to run everything that's runnable. So we have 3 runnable things. We'll run one for 2 milliseconds, another for 2 milliseconds, another for 2 milliseconds, then the first one for 2, so it will run every 6 milliseconds. If we have 4, we'll split up the 6 milliseconds into 4, and so on, but not so far that we make our time quantum less than 0.75 milliseconds. If that happens, they won't run every 6 milliseconds, but that's a compromise we're willing to make because we care about throughput too much. So the time quantum is the time window divided by the number of things that are runnable, but the minimum quantum if that's too small. So this is choosing our time quantum. And so this is, so if we have 2 processes with the same virtual time, we'll choose one of them and it will run for this time quantum before we switch away. Now, you asked the question about, well, what about a new task comes along, it has a much lower virtual time, what should I do about it? And there are conflicting goals there, too, that we want to run it right away because that's fairer, it deserves to run now because it hasn't run for a while. But we also want to avoid excessive context switches. And the completely fair scheduler has this heuristic rule that if the virtual time is less by a certain threshold, we'll switch right away, otherwise we won't. So to limit that effect. So if it's too close, we're just going to say, yeah, this is not exactly what the virtual time says to do, but you know, we're fine with that because we don't want to context switch over and over again if like a bunch of I/O operations finish all at the same time. Okay, some questions? Yes. So let's do a little exercise here. So I have a program A, which is doing this pattern of it uses 2 milliseconds of CPU, then waits for I/O for 3 milliseconds, then uses 2 milliseconds of CPU, and so on. I have program B, which uses 1 millisecond of CPU, then waits for I/O for about 1.5 milliseconds. And program C, which just wants to use all the CPU it can get. What is CFS going to do with this? And your answer might depend on some of those scheduling parameters, like if a new program comes along after I/O, what virtual time do we set it to? Like how far back do we let it go? I'll give you a minute to think about this. So about what portion? Like, does it get a third? Does it get more than a third? Less than a third? You can check with your neighbor if you... Okay, so who has part of an answer? So this is a... So the answer here, the answers here do depend a lot on the scheduler parameters. So it turns out there's a range of things which could happen, but there's some things which can't, and some things which definitely can. So can someone give me some example of something, you know, something we can say about how often A runs? Yeah.
2 fifths.
So why 2 fifths?
Because, like, it doesn't really matter which one starts first, but, like, if A started first and switched to B, then it would switch to C, and, like, B is only going to run for 1, and then it's going to wait for IO.
Okay, so... So you're saying there is a schedule where we run A, then B, then C, where A gets 2/5 of the time? Note that A wants 2/5 of the CPU time. If we run A alone, it's going to use 2/5 of the CPU time. So it can't get any more than that. So if you have answers which are higher than 2/5, there's a problem that A's doing I/O 3/4 of the time, so we can't do that. Now, I think exactly 2/5 might be possible, but I think it's unlikely, and the biggest problem is that B also wants to run 2/5 of the time, and C wants to run all of the time. And if they all have the same weight, then this means that we're going to try to aim for a third, a third, and a third. Okay. So if we assume that we set that we don't have any issue with waking up from sleep and so on, we'd estimate that we get roughly a third, and a third, because we evenly divide up the CPU time between things over the long term. Assuming that we don't say, oh, you've been sleeping for too long, I'm going to not give you credit for those whole 3 milliseconds. We assume that A gets credit, you know, for waiting 3 milliseconds without using the CPU, we're going to get a third and not 2/5. So that's a subtlety here. Okay, so that's my baseline. But it's definitely no bigger than 2/5. That's the first thing we need to figure out, right, is how much could A run if we keep letting it run? And my next step here is I say, well, if we split things up perfectly evenly, if we don't have to worry about, like, time quantums and the actual advantage for waking up from sleep is that we just, like, say we're just tracking virtual time, not doing any adjustments, we're going to all have a third at most. Like, that's the most we could possibly have. So any reasons why we'd go lower? Reasons why we wouldn't get that, yeah. So you're saying if we prioritize, prioritize how? So we're saying if we run A before we run C. So I agree that. So how would we do that in CFS? Like, what are we adjusting? So in CFS, the way we have to adjust priority would be weights. So indeed, if we set weights for these, that could happen. If we didn't set weights, though, A would get at most a third of the CPU, even though it's interactive. Because our notion without weights is that even though C is not interactive, and therefore we learned less important for responsiveness, that's not the schedule we chose. But any ideas for less? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, the actual, like, CPU time is a little bit, like, less than 1/3, I think.
So you're saying it would be a little less than 1/3 because A is waiting for IO. So now your notion was their virtual run times are almost the same.
Yeah.
So the question is, how does A run a little less because of that? And remember, since we equalize the virtual run times by running the lowest, it has to be the case that the virtual run times end up not being the same. But you've given me the mechanism for that to happen, which is that A waits for IO, for a while, and one thing which could happen is we have this scenario, that, yeah, the virtual runtimes are almost equal, but they're almost equal because we rounded A's up. So if that happened, then A would run for less than a third, which I think is sort of the thing you're getting at. Yeah. So it would be because of our parameter saying, hey, you were sleeping, we don't count all that time, sorry. Okay. So any other concerns people can think of which might make it lower than one third? So, yeah. So if A spends too much time sleeping,
you have to run C all the time.
You have to run C, okay. So you're worried that A will spend so much time sleeping that it will decrease lower than one third, but A doesn't spend a third of its time sleeping with this, probably. But so I would spend more than that time sleeping. So I guess a concern we could have is that A might spend more time sleeping because B runs and delays A's IO. So that would be a way A could spend more time sleeping. And maybe it would end up being the case that A is now spending more time not running, and therefore gets less than a third of the time. Because if we think of, you know, instead of having A do 2 milliseconds and then 3, we have A does like a millisecond, then B runs, then A does its remaining millisecond. And now we have like a higher interval between when A can run. So that would be another concern, is that because B gets to run before A sometimes, depending on how our virtual times work out, it might be the case that A has to wait longer between completing its IOs. And so it doesn't get its full third of the CPU. So now this is big. So you can see like these parameters are like complicated moving pieces, and it's actually pretty tricky to figure out exactly what will happen, except in the really simple scenario where we say it's just virtual runtimes. And CFS has even more stuff than that. So one thing it needs to deal with is multiple CPUs, so there's additional complications from that. You want to worry about related tasks and some special cases. So that's sort of an additional thing CFS has. So it's actually a complicated thing. And I have a minute, and I have a last slide on CFS. So CFS this scheduling approach is very similar to an academic approach by the same people who wrote about lottery schedulers initially called stride scheduling. And you can think of it as sort of a deterministic version of lottery schedulers with some extra stuff added in to handle things being asleep. And it's also similar to things which occur in very different domains. So it's similar to a type of network scheduling known as weighted fair queuing. So if you take a networking class and learn about how switches do schedule different network traffic fairly, it's the same algorithm, just with different names. Okay, that's what I have for today.